Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a special, in-depth, original investigative report, Chinese Botanical Medicine. Wikipedia claims it's fake. We are certain it is real. Richard Gale and myself have done the research on this. This will be posted later on PRN.FM with all of the references intact. Modern conventional medicine has increasingly become a culture of scientific and historical denialism. Although pretending to be an objective discipline of continuous progress, the medical establishment more often than not denies the insights, discoveries, medical systems, and methodologies of the distant past as well as non-Western cultures. In effect, if it weren't created in America, it couldn't be any good. That's how bridled with narcissism the American scientific culture has become. Instead, what we have is Western medicine is racing more rapidly towards a retro future with a blind faith in the promises of a new engineered synthetic drug culture. Everybody should be drugged. And that's exactly what is happening. Sadly, this pursuit is misconstrued as synonymous with important medical breakthroughs and the evolution of scientific medicine. Yet, as the statistics will show, modern medicine is on a collision course with itself. And this is most evident in the increasing failures conventional medicine faces in fighting all of the life-threatening diseases and the annual increases in iatrogenic injuries and deaths. Upon graduation, every physician in the United States must repeat an oath, and it says, I will not give a lethal drug to anyone if I am asked, nor will I advise such a plan. The oath composed by the wise Greek medical sage Hippocrates goes on to say, I will use those dietary regimens which will benefit my patients according to my greatest ability and judgment, and I will do no harm or injustice to them. Hippocrates was a naturalist, a vitalist, great intuition. Unlike physicians today, he was expert in the healing powers found in the natural world and was a keen observer about the health benefits of different foods and plants and herbs. However, modern allopathic doctors are not only largely ignorant about the natural world, especially in the prevention of disease, they have also removed themselves from honoring the Hippocratic Oath. How well has modern medicine lived up to its oath? Adverse drug events, or ADEs, are rising. They have become a plague upon the public health and our healthcare system. As of 2014, prescription drug injuries totaled 1.6 million events every 12 months. Every day, over 4,000 Americans experience a serious drug reaction requiring hospitalization. An additional 770,000 people have adverse drug reactions during hospital stays. The most common adverse drug reactions are hypertension, congestive heart failure, atrial fibrillation, volume depletion disorders, and atherosclerotic heart disease. According to the CDC, in 2016, there were 64,070 deaths directly associated with prescription overdosing, meaning the person killed themselves. This is greater than the number of American soldiers killed during the entire Vietnam War. For 2017, the CDC reported over 42,000 deaths from prescription opiate drugs alone. Most of those, but not all, are used for pain. Yet the figure is probably much higher due to the CDC's practice of reporting statistics very conservatively. So when we consider that there were over 860,000 physicians in the United States practicing last year, potentially most physicians in America have contributed to adverse drug reactions. So here's the question. Where is the admonishment? Where is there a cautionary note? Where is there a caveat emptor? Consumer beware. What have we done to lessen this carnage? Nothing. No legitimate and highly developed alternative or natural medical practice has such a dismal track record of illness and death. Nevertheless, on that rarest of occasion when an adverse drug reaction has poisoned someone, or there's been an adverse event, immediately the skeptics in the radical fringe of science-based medicine who rabidly oppose complementary and alternative medicine and traditional Chinese medicine are quick to report the incident as a national crisis and condemn the use of that entire therapy, in effect, trying to condemn all of traditional Chinese medicine. Yet if we look at the potential number of iatrogenic injuries and deaths over the last four decades since the start of the pharmaceutical and biotechnology boom in the late 1980s, we're looking at over, listen carefully, 60 million casualties caused by conventional Western medicine. This is nothing to celebrate, and no concerted national effort within the medical establishment or science-based medicine followers is being made to challenge the medical paradigm responsible for this crisis. But in our previous investigative reporting articles in this series exposing the scientific denialism and ideological agenda of skepticism and Wikipedia's role in promoting science-based medicine's regressive agenda to turn people away from non-conventional drug-based medicine, we tackled science-based medicine's and Wikipedia's attack on acupuncture. Today, I'm going to focus upon Chinese medical herbology. And in mainland China, acupuncture and herbology are treated as separate disciplines. Therefore, we will look at Chinese botanical medicine and separately from acupuncture. Wikipedia has a noteworthy amount to say about traditional Chinese herbal medicine. However, its major criticisms rely heavily upon five-plus-year-old reviews of peer-reviewed research. Some references, in fact, have nothing to do with Chinese herbology at all. Why didn't its editors catch this? Where are their fact-checkers? Where is their scholarship? The majority of clinical research into Chinese botanicals and medicinal preparations are only found in Chinese databases. Well, here's a question. How can you call yourself an expert in anything if it's in a language you don't read? And if 95% of all the literature is published only in that language, then what are you reading? Therefore, Western analytical reviews, including the Cochrane reports, are extremely limited and consequently inconclusive and biased. Critics of traditional Chinese medicine frequently criticize published Chinese research as incomplete, some containing errors or even misleading. These are the same criticisms the skeptics on Wikipedia level against traditional herbal medical systems in general. So we decided to do an in-depth analysis for over a year. What we found on the National Institutes of Health, PubMed, that's the America's scientific community and the federal government's own database, 181,000, I repeat, 181,000 peer-reviewed scientific papers are published there, referring to Chinese medicine. So from my perspective, it is absolutely ridiculous, not just disingenuous, to assume Wikipedia's editors have scoured this massive body of science to make any sound judgment about traditional Chinese medicine's efficacy. And at any time, did they contact the Chinese Academy of Medicine? Did they contact some of the leading MD, PhDs including those teaching in the United States or practicing in the United States, to question them on any aspect of traditional Chinese medicine. No. So how can you say that you're an expert on a topic and you do not interview any of the people who are actually MD PhDs in the field, working for decades, publishing in peer-reviewed literature, seeing thousands of patients, and those are the experts, and you don't talk with them, and you don't read Chinese, and you don't read 151,000 scientific reports? And yet the public would not know that, nor the media, nor anyone sitting on a congressional hearing, if someone were to say, well, as an expert, I'm telling you that there's no basis. This is all quackery, or it's all pseudoscience. Who on that committee would know to challenge them? Because they, too, would not have been speaking and fluent in Chinese, let alone the science of Chinese medicine, let alone understanding the literature, nor even speaking with the patients who've been treated by the hundreds of millions of patients over thousands of years. And so out of hand, they just discarded all of it. That's American media. That's American journalism. That's American science. That's American medicine. That's why I'm challenging it, because we are at the lowest point in my career, in my life, of seeing science that has become so orthodox, so ramrod rigid, so biased, so lacking in curiosity, that it has completely enabled itself to a pharmaceutical model. So under the heading Chinese Herbology, Wikipedia states, quote, a Nature editorial described TCM as traditional Chinese medicine as fraught with pseudoscience, and said the most obvious reason why it has not delivered many cures is that the majority of its treatments have no logical mechanism of action. Research into the effectiveness of traditional Chinese herbal therapy is of poor quality and often tainted by bias with little or no rigorous evidence of efficacy, end quote. The journal Nature editorial, which reflects the same ill-informed opinions, frequent in skeptical criticism about natural health, does not cite any research to support its sweeping prejudice and subjective opinion. As an example, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, New York City, you have large Chinese populations. There you also have the majority of Chinese practicing physicians. Did they interview any? If they say that something's not working, and in China you have 1.3 billion people, and if Chinese medicine has been used for 5,000 years, you're talking about tens of billions of people who've been treated. There are thousands of texts in Chinese. And how many of those people did they interview? How about none? Can you just for a moment imagine that amount of hubris and arrogance to define an entire history of science and healing and give it no credibility whatsoever, and you've done nothing to do real homework to see the truth of something? And that's how it works. We would be negligent in stating one serious concern that everyone should have regarding Chinese medicinal herbs and preparations, and this is because you must have a knowledge of whether or not there are any levels of toxic contaminants, notably arsenic, lead, and other toxic materials. And the reason for this is because China, at least in the last 40 years, has become extremely polluted. And this is because of toxic airborne particulate matter and toxic waste that spills into water supplies, and frequently that's used for irrigation. However, there are other countries such as Japan and Taiwan that have very strict federal regulations for the import and export of medical botanicals, and hence they have clean, non-toxic botanical herbs and preparations that are available as well. Now, one of science-based medicine's leading spokespersons is David Gorski, and he'd like us to believe that Mao Zedong should be condemned for restoring traditional Chinese medicine in mainland China. But this is a gross half-truth. In fact, Gorski and his colleagues have far more in common with Chairman Mao, in my opinion, based upon the actual historical facts. And I would like for someone at Wikipedia, since you claim to know so much, and I claim to challenge you, you don't, to do a little homework. It was actually during Mao Zedong's reign that classical Chinese medicine took an enormous leap backwards. The ancient system was originally banned during the Chinese nationalist movement during the early 20th century because its leaders believed the old ways were preventing the nation from modernizing. Mao initially made a small token effort to restore the practice. However, it was after the Communist Revolution when Mao turned against traditional Chinese medicine. The Cultural Revolution again outlawed the practice of traditional Chinese medicine. The traditional Chinese doctors who retained the most extensive knowledge and wisdom about the energy of the body and knowledge of medicinal herbs were systematically gathered for communist conversion programs. They were imprisoned or killed. And traditional Chinese medicine literally came within one wisp of dying completely from the mainland of China. Now, years later, when the communists attempted to resurrect the ancient medical wisdom, only a handful, a few hundred doctors in all of China could be found with sufficient knowledge to start the traditional Chinese medicine anew. And yet Mao remained ambiguous. He wrote, quote, "Even though I believe we should promote Chinese medicine, I personally don't believe in it. I don't take Chinese medicine," end quote. Unfortunately, what is commonly called traditional Chinese medicine today is a partial reconstruction of the ancient system that could be recovered and revived. Much of it, however, has been lost. The government's efforts failed, and according to Dr. Brigetta Shea, quote, "Once the government decided to reinstate some form of Chinese traditional medicine, they did it with an emphasis upon combining it with Western medical theory. They shifted even acupuncture theory as Western teachings was adopted, and esoteric and subtle anatomy was discarded. So the result was that traditional Chinese medicine today is just a mere shadow of what it was in the past and is a little more than a watered-down system contaminated with Western reductionist medical theories. Fortunately, growing interest in traditional Chinese medicine is inspiring young researchers and practitioners to travel to China and Taiwan and Japan and Korea to try to recover the more ancient classical medical teachings that have not been included in the standardized traditional Chinese medicine curriculum." Science-based medicine founder Stephen Novella remarked, quote, "Traditional Chinese medicine is a pre-scientific superstitious view of biology and illness, similar to the humoral theory of Galen, or the notions of any pre-scientific culture. It is strange and unscientific to treat traditional Chinese medicine as anything else. Any individual diagnostic or treatment method within traditional Chinese medicine should be evaluated according to standard principles of science and science-based medicine and not given special treatment." The remainder of Novella's argument is an example of taking traditional Chinese medicine terms literally and not penetrating their deeper functions to discover their correlations with scientifically identified biomolecular substances and events. Novella also believes that the Chinese medical theories of qi and acupuncture meridians share the same magical thinking as ether and phlogiston and Bigfoot and unicorns. So it's completely mocked and ridiculed. The master physicians of the more advanced traditional medical systems of Greece and India and China and Tibet were very skilled and astute in identifying metabolic disturbances in their patients. Now, although on the surface the humors may appear to be outdated or primitive methodological terms, a deep study of the traditional medical text reveal they have direct correspondences to biochemical and biological processes that are well known in modern medicine. For example, according to the recent translators of the enormous medical corpus composed by one of the world's greatest medical doctors, Avicenna, in the 11th century, who revived the medical theories of Galen at the height of the Islamic civilization's golden age, Dr. Hakimi Amari, professor of molecular biology at Georgetown University, and Dr. Monis Abu Asab, a senior scientist and expert in a phylogenetic systematics at the National Institute of Health, discovered the ancient descriptions of the humors have a direct correlation to properties of fats, proteins, and organic acids, and the cornerstones of metabolic changes. And due to this linear and non-systematic way of analyzing health and disease, modern medicine focuses upon single metabolic pathways and fails to consider that these pathways work in conjunction or concert with others. For example, a patient with a high LDL cholesterol will be prescribed a statin drug without fully understanding the biological imbalances that increased the LDL. But traditional herbal systems, including Chinese herbology, provide more parameters, such as a tissue's hydration and the energy production in the case of abnormal cholesterol levels. And Western medicine does not take into account hydration and energy production in making an accurate diagnostic assessment of the reasons for the imbalance. This is where the ancient theory of humors, or the fundamental fluids in the body, traditionally defined as blood, phlegm, yellow or black bile, provides clues. Western medicine has no equivalent to what traditional systems refer to as distemperment in a biological system or organ. Distemperment was understood as an imbalance in a person's unique, personalized physical, genetic, and psychological disposition and the emerging discipline of functional medicine, and finds agreement with this principle for diagnosing and treating an illness. In fact, conventional medicine still endeavors to define the cause of many diseases at a single cellular molecular level, and only when it becomes classically defined. What do I mean? It's this simple. Let's say you go to a doctor, and you tell the doctor that you have a problem. The doctor will see whether or not your problem or the symptoms you're explaining correspond to tests that doctor can take to define an illness. If the doctor's diagnostic processes can determine a classically defined illness, high blood pressure, a tumor, a blocked artery, then the doctor will start the process as if the disease is just now being got underway. Instead of understanding that might have taken 30 to 40 years to have evolved to where a classically defined illness can even be diagnosed. So, in effect, when doctors say we have found the disease and we got it early, no, you're 30 years late to the party. Also, in Chinese medicine, if you have anger issues, if you have crying issues, every kind of emotional issue and family problem are all taken into account. And that's why they want to know whether or not your phlegm is a certain way or your bile's a certain way, your liver, your spleen. They want to know about the humorals. They want to know about your pulse. I once interviewed the physician for the Dalai Lama, and I asked him, how many pulses are you reading? He said seven. In America, you're only taught there is one pulse. That's it. One pulse. They're reading seven. Now, how is it that all of traditional medicine that the Dalai Lama and others have been using have a far greater knowledge of what upsets or balances a body than we do? Because we have over-specialized. We are not allowing the doctor to take quality time with the patient. We're not allowing the doctor to see whether or not the emotional state, the stress levels, the workload, the work environment, the place a person lives, is it toxic or non? Is it green or not green? Is a person overworked? Are they not getting enough rest? Are they getting enough exercise? Are they getting enough liquids in their body? Are they hydrated? All of these are crucial to understanding what you're dealing with. Yet Chinese medicine takes the time and looks at all of that. We don't. And as a result, we have a high level of misdiagnosis or wrong diagnosis and then wrong treatment. So for half a century, we have spent hundreds of billions of dollars on reductionist biomedical research to identify genes, proteins, and metabolic biochemical changes that contribute to disease. But despite the enormous body of knowledge and data we've gathered from astronomical and costly projects that have been few practical and meaningful results to find safe and effective treatments outside of prescribing potentially lethal drugs. Most evidence-based medicine reviews of research conducted on the efficacy of specific Chinese herbs fail to take into account that Chinese herbology is a complete system. It is unrealistic to research a single traditional Chinese herb and draw a definitive conclusion. An herbal concoction can include 18 or more ingredients, and these are simmered for hours to produce pharmatherapeutic properties useful for the treatment of disease. This was noted in a Cochrane review of Chinese medicinal herbs for treating acute pancreatitis. It is estimated there are over 13,000 different medicinal ingredients found in the annals of Chinese medical texts, with over 100,000 unique deconcoctions and recipes. And while the vast majority of substances used in Chinese medical preparations are plant-based, they also, in some cases, use parts of animals or minerals. But regardless of the skeptics and Wikipedia's invective diminishing of Chinese medicine's efficacy and success, Chinese medicine is booming, and extraordinary research continues to pump out positive discoveries. Even Bayer Pharmaceutical purchased the Chinese herb company Daihan Pharmaceutical Group in 2014 because of the huge potential of discovery, powerful phytochemicals to treat a wide variety of diseases. Helmut Kaiser Consultancy in Germany predicts that the annual revenue in Chinese botanicals will triple in the next few years to $17 billion. So what skeptics and Wikipedia fail to acknowledge is that the 2015 Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Chinese scientist Tu Youyou for her use of the Chinese medicinal remedy Artemisia for developing an antimalarial drug. In 2015, researchers at the Texas Biomedical Research Institute and the Center for Integrated Protein Science in Munich published their findings in the peer-reviewed journal Science of an alkaloid in an ingredient of the Chinese formula Hanfangji, protecting human white blood cells from the Ebola virus. In 2006, the FDA gave its first drug approval to an oriental-based ointment, botanicals, including green tea leaves, to treat genital warts caused by human papillomavirus. In a bioinformatics database analysis comparing traditional Chinese medicine botanicals with a modern comprehensive medical chemistry database, over 100 Chinese herbs were found to have their correlates in approved pharmaceutical drugs on the market. So where do you come off saying there is no science? We found over 150,000 plus studies, and I'm just citing a few. I'll give you one excellent example of the synergistic effect of herbal combinations in traditional Chinese medicine is the duo Copatitis rhizome, as well as Evodia reticarpia. In traditional Chinese practice, it's been given for centuries to treat gastric conditions, including rapidly healing of ulcers. So modern research has shown that together these herbs inhibit the bacterium Helicobacter pylori, which frequently accompanies ulcers. In the United States, approximately 20% of people under 40 years and over 50% of people above 60 years of age are estimated to have H. pylori infection, which can be responsible for gastritis, stomach and duodenal ulcers, gastric lymphoma, and stomach cancer. So the herbs were also found to contain limonene, used as an anti-neoplastic chemical, and agomelanoic acid, used in an ingredient in modern pharmaceuticals anti-tumor treatments. Finally, we might take a look at the 2018 flu season. In fact, the influenza vaccine for this past season was a dud and failed to protect most recipients from infection. According to the CDC, the vaccine was 36% effective. Almost 100 pediatric flu deaths were reported. However, later research at Rice University determined the vaccine at best was only 20% effective. That means it was 80% non-effective. Well, with conventional medicine and our federal health agencies failing to protect the public, tens of thousands of other people experiencing the onset of flu-like symptoms rushed out to purchase the Chinese herbal cold formula, Nin Jim Pi Pa Ko, for like $6 in New York Chinatown. Now, this formula is one of the most popular cold and flu cough remedies across East Asia and Singapore. It was first formulated during the Qing Dynasty in the 17th century. The results were immediate, and when we desire relief from a health condition, that's all that matters. In conclusion, we have absolutely no need for skeptics preaching from their bully pulpits, nor the vitriol of science-based medicine's priesthood, nor Wikipedia's encyclopedia of biased misinformation to parrot skepticism's paranoia and efforts to censor natural health. We don't need any of them to tell us our relief from taking medicinal herbs or natural formulas is only a placebo effect or figment of our imagination because the scientific research doesn't meet their standards. The fact of the matter is that the science will never meet their standards because fundamentalists, either religious or science-based, cannot be persuaded by evidence or facts that conflict with their ingrained psychological ideologies and fears. And this is the fundamental fallacy and blatant hypocrisy that runs through science-based medicine skepticism. It is not science-based because it is impoverished by the necessary inquisitive mind, the open-mindedness that defines people who can authentically call themselves scientists. Science-based medicine is faith-based and holds fealty with a grossly reductionist and petulant, bratish mentality incapable of seeing the forest for the trees. In his criticism of traditional Chinese medicine, Novella brings the absurdity of skepticism to a climax. Quote, I maintain that there are many good reasons to conclude that any system, i.e. traditional Chinese medicine, which derives from everyday experience is likely to be seriously flawed and almost entirely cut off from reality, end quote. However, we have for thousands of years and countless number of people have claimed benefits from Chinese herbology. We do not accept their scientific reductionist validation of our reality. And good sir, if you believe that everyone's experiences day to day at an individual or collective level are not essential, then that is a completely open discussion because we have a lot of people who have changed their lifestyles, who've changed their diets, who've changed their attitudes, and are healthier and happier today because of it. I'm Gary Nall. This article will be published later today on Progressive Radio Network's website, prn.fm. Before we take a break and go to our guest, we had a power outage at one of our sister stations, WBAI, yesterday, and I'm not sure that the people had a chance to hear the program that was broadcast on PRN. They have a standby program that we gave him with Danny Sheehan. I just want to share one insight. I spoke on Sunday in England to Brandon, the young fellow who is leading the movement called Walk Away. And it is my opinion, and I shared this with him, that he should be very conscientious that if you're walking away from a movement, don't make the mistake of walking right into the alt-right or to those in the conservative movement, because all of the sites that you're on, these are very conservative. Now, they have a right to that view, but you're not really then gaining anything, because both the right and the left, the corporate right and the corporate left, are controlled by forces that work carefully to alienate people. They both come from hate. They both come from fear-mongering. They both come from attacking the other. They never sit and try to understand each other. So those of us who at one time were aligned with the left or the right, and we've seen its promises broken, we've seen what it will not address, we've seen how it has not supported progressive ideals and healing at the level that we will not invade countries, we will have universal health care, we will clean up our environment, we will honor nature, we will honor our health. They're not doing it, neither one. So I gave him my advice. I suggested that he take his step away, fine, but don't go into the right or the conservative movement, because they'll just use you like you're the new Milo. You'll be astroturfing out there for them. I played the full segments so people could hear the things that were obviously meant to convince this young fellow that, yeah, you don't like the left? Good. We've got the right answers. No, they do not. Neither has the right answers. Go independent. At least go to a state where you're not attached to, you can do your homework, and then look carefully at groups and individuals that are not a part of the financial system, the Wall Street system, the industrialist system, the political system, and then lend that energy. We have created such a system, and it's called Walk Progressive, where we support everything I just mentioned, ending wars, closing military bases around the world, getting rid of money and financing, emptying out the prison system, decriminalizing the war on drugs, purging those people's records with clemency, and cleaning up our environment, de-ghettoizing America, free college, public college and school education, cleaning up those debts. We did it for the banks. We could do it for the students. There's so many humanistic things we could do if we valued human life. And a lot of people are making that move. We estimate 100 million independent people in the United States, and a lot of them are progressive. Keep those liberal values that you value, that have worked well with you and will work well in the future. Keep those conservative values that you value. Just stay away from the ideologies. Stay away from the absolutism, because those undermine anything else that you might have had that will work for you. We're going to take a break and come back. You stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the United States. We're going down to Pennsylvania now, and we're going to say hello to Dr. Roy Edelson. He is a practicing clinical and research and political psychologist for over 30 years, and focusing on the psychological issues of civil justice and social change. He's the former executive director of the Solomon Asch Center for Study of Ethno-political conflict at the University of Pennsylvania, and and we have him here today to talk about political mind games, the psychology behind the elite's manipulation and marketing of false social and political claims to get us to support their self-serving agenda. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's good to be here.
The vast majority of our debates in this country over political policy and internal conflicts are analyzed from a socioeconomic or political affiliation perspective, rather than to look at the issues from a deeper psychological and ethical construct to understand what is really going on. So I'm pleased to have you on the program today to increase our psychological understanding of the widespread discord and confusion we find ourselves in today when fake news are the new postmodern truths. And I'd like an analogy you provide from an episode of Rod Serling's Twilight Zone in the 1960s TV series, or Aliens, which could be our 1% of the national plutocratic elite who covertly manipulate normal conditions in a small town and then realize all they have to do is sit back and watch as the citizens' thoughts and attitudes and prejudices and suspicions destroy themselves. In other words, the aliens have set up the psychological conditions for horrible decisions and policies to be made that serve the elite and have the support of at least pacify the population into inaction. So please begin by speaking about the crucial role psychology plays in the decisions being made at the federal level and the underlying psychology that is leading us to a horrible future. And before I give you the forum, I'll just give you one example, and I have a bunch. Mm-hmm. That is, we say we are against terrorism. Good. And yet we, along with Saudi Arabia and Turkey and United Arab Emirates and Israel, we support fully terrorist organizations throughout the world. And no one in the media or the mainstream media is challenging this cognitive disconnect. If you're against something, then why are you supporting it? The forum is yours.
Okay. All good points. My focus for many years has been on psychological persuasion and how it's used in politics. And over the course of that time, I've developed a perspective that looks specifically at what I call five core psychological concerns. And I think that these are the soft targets that, in particular, those with tremendous wealth and power use in order to pursue what they want at the expense of the common good. So probably helpful if I name these five briefly. First one is vulnerability. We are constantly asking ourselves, are we safe? And if we get the answer right, or if we figure out what needs to be done, that's good. But often we're persuaded in ways that make us misjudge our safety or our welfare, or make the wrong decisions about how to be safer. So vulnerability is one of those core psychological concerns. Second one is injustice. The basic question we ask is, are we being treated fairly? Whenever we think someone or we are not being treated fairly, we try and correct that, and we are often filled with resentment and an urge to kind of bring accountability to those we hold responsible. Unfortunately, we're often misled in regard to either where the injustice is or who's to blame for it. So that's the second one, injustice. The third core concern is distrust. Who should we trust? We tend to divide the world into those who we find trustworthy and those we don't. And where we draw that line matters a lot. If we get it right, we avoid harm from those who are out to hurt us, and we can enjoy the rewards of positive relationships. But we frequently get it wrong, and influential actors try to encourage us to make the wrong judgment about who we can trust and who we can't. So that's distrust, the third core concern. The fourth is superiority, and basic question that goes with it is, are we good enough? It's human nature to compare ourselves to others, and we often do that in order to demonstrate that we're worthy of respect or even admiration. But too often, in order to bolster kind of our own positive self-appraisal, we're encouraged to perceive others as in as negative a light as possible, often to the point of dehumanizing them. And the final psychological core concern that the 1% target with manipulative appeals is helplessness. The question being, can we control what happens to us? So feelings of helplessness are kind of poison for any undertaking. If we believe we can't control the important outcomes in our lives, we become resigned, it wrecks our motivation, and we stop working toward important personal or collective objectives. Now, the analysis I present in my book, Political Mind Games, is that these five psychological concerns, vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness, are central to how we make sense of the world around us. And they should be, and ideally would be, crucial guideposts for efforts to advance the common good. And you, Gary, offered many examples of what that common good would look like in terms of universal health care, a reduction in our military budget, free tuition, and so on. But as I explain in the book, these very same concerns are soft and highly attractive targets for those who want to prey on our doubts and uncertainties to achieve their own goals. And they're very good at it. And so it doesn't break down along kind of Democratic or Republican lines necessarily. It breaks down, I believe, in terms of those who have tremendous wealth and power and the rest of us. And we know from very good research that Congress is influenced by what the 1% want in terms of laws, regulations, and they don't care based on their actions, based on their votes. They essentially don't care what the 99% want. It's not surprising when you consider how important the role of money is. But recognizing these five core concerns, what I try and do is explain what I call the mind games, what kind of political, psychological, manipulative appeals we see every day, constantly, that are designed to influence the way we make sense of the world.
Okay, and that said, one of the major mind games being played now and getting the most media attention concerns immigration and travel bans of Muslims and separation of parents from children. It's abhorrent. Using this as an example, what is the mind game being played, and what is its intended effects?
Well, the key mind game there, I believe, is what I refer to as they're different from us. So this is the argument that 1%ers will offer. They'll, you know, sometimes disguise it. Sometimes they'll be quite open about it. It's designed to work on kind of the difference between in-group and out-groups. It's a natural human tendency to have an in-group bias. If we're persuaded that someone belongs to a different group from us, that is an out-group, it negatively colors our judgments and behavior toward them, whereas if we're persuaded that someone belongs to our in-group, then we tend to view them as more trustworthy, we hold them in higher regard, we're more willing to do what needs to be done to help them. And what we see on multiple fronts, from the current White House, and not just the White House, are efforts to play on this, they're different from us. And we see it in regard to the immigration issue and the, you know, horrific separation of parents from their children at the border, or even if not separated, their incarceration together. But there's there's money behind this. All of the, you know, prejudice, there are profiteers of prejudice, and they will take advantage of the opportunity to make money on appeals that stimulate us to feel that others are different. So you look at the for-profit prison industry. It loves the fact that more immigrants are being locked up. That is money in the bank for them. The travel ban, anything that scares us about Muslims is money for the security industry and for defense contractors. They make a fortune as long as we remain scared about terrorism as something that's out there and that is somehow attached to a religion, even though it certainly is not. And we see it, you know, in terms of kind of the African-American community, we see it in terms of mass incarceration. Large corporations financially benefit from having a lot of people locked up. And among other ways, that's inexpensive, below minimum wage labor, in addition to the various business enterprises, the costs of phone calls, the meals, the health care. So that by preying on the they're different from us mind game, a lot of us kind of step aside. We kind of don't feel the connection to these people who are being harmed terribly. And at the same time, the 1% are making money and are keeping us divided.
Also, I appreciate that insight. Thank you. And we're almost out of time. I just want to make this point. Look at what it would have been like to have been a unionist. I spoke with these people out in West Virginia. You spent your whole life working at a simple job, and the factory closed, and it was outsourced. You've been given repeated promises by people who said they support unions, support the poor, the Democrats, and they didn't. So out of anger and as a protest, you voted for Trump. You feel you had nothing else to lose, and now you hear yourself being called deplorable. That's a game that the Democratic establishment has been playing by denigrating everyone as if everyone who voted for Trump and everyone who comes to his rallies is a white-necked racist, a redneck racist, a white supremacist, a misogynist, a hater. And though there are a small number of those there and always have been, that sure as the heck does not represent the vast majority of people out there. But we're being played that mind game. As if they're the other. They don't deserve they're not our intellectual equal, they're not our educational equal, they're not our financial equal, they're not our social cultural equal, so they're all to be dismissed. And I think that is also a mistake. The games are being played on both sides, and they're both wrong. That's my opinion.
I agree with you. That's another example of the they're different from us mind game. And in political mind games, I describe 20 of these mind games with the specific examples of how they're being used and what we can do about it.
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour so you can go through all 20 of those. I want to hear them myself, all right?
That sounds like great. That would be great.
Great. And in the interim, Dr. Roy Edelson's book is called Political Mind Games, How the 1% Manipulate Our Understanding of What is Happening, What's Right, and What's Possible. Thank you very much. And his website is roiedelson.com. I'm Gary Nollett. We're out of time, everyone. And tonight at 7 o'clock, three dynamic speakers on what's wrong with artificial intelligence. You don't want to miss that. It's going to be very exciting. Have a nice day, everyone.
Dancing, dancing. She's a dancing machine.
A baby.